This is the Mindful Musical Life Podcast. I'm Kevin Miske. Before we jump into this week's interview, I wanted to share a bit of exciting news. I have developed a 4-week introduction to mindfulness for musicians. Through 4 30-minute private meetings with me and structured private practice on your own, you will gain an understanding of the main elements of mindfulness, learn some mindfulness practices, and develop exercises to incorporate mindfulness into your music making. If you are interested in a free 30-minute consultation to discuss this course and see if it's right for you, please reach out to me via Instagram at mindfulmusicallife or via email at mindfulmusicallife@gmail.com. I am beyond excited to introduce the guest for this week. After a few haphazard interactions with mindfulness, I decided to attend a workshop back in 2017 on mindfulness for musicians at Indiana University while I was finishing up my doctoral work. From that moment on, I was totally hooked, and it's all thanks to Frank Diaz. Frank is an associate professor of music and music education at the Indiana University Jacobs School of Music. An active scholar and teacher in the field of contemplative science, he is also an affiliate faculty member for the IU Cognitive Science Program. At Jacobs, Diaz teaches courses on instrumental music education, research methods, and mindfulness for musicians. He is also a highly sought-out clinician and conductor for honors, community, secondary, and collegiate orchestras, and is a frequent presenter and adjudicator for conferences, workshops, and festivals across the country. Diaz is the founder and director of the Institute for Mindfulness-Based Wellness and Pedagogy, where he collaborates with an international group of artists, educators, and scholars on disseminating research and best practices on the art of mindful living, teaching, and performance. He has taught meditative practices to thousands of students through courses and workshops at educational, religious, and nonprofit institutions across the United States, and leads several mindfulness initiatives through partnerships with the Jacobs School of Music, IU Lifelong Learning, and the Eskenazi Museum of Art. Frank has such an amazing way of presenting and teaching mindfulness and helping people to understand what that word truly means. I'm thrilled to share this wonderful conversation. So without further ado, here's Frank. Hi, Frank. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so excited to reconnect with you and to share some of your experiences with everyone you've had years and years of both teaching and practicing of mindfulness. And so I thought it'd be really great to start with your observations about the most common ways that students get interested in mindfulness at the college level. What brings them to mindfulness when they first get going?
Yeah, thanks for the question, and thanks for having me here on the podcast, Kevin. I'm excited about this. I'm glad you're doing it, I'm just delighted to spend a little bit of time with you talking about this today. I know we have a pretty good long history of having these discussions, so this will be fun. All right, so let's talk about students and college students now. I can start with just sort of what's going on at the Jacobs School.
Sure.
Because that is where a lot of what I'm doing takes place. We have a course in the spring where I teach mindfulness to performance majors, mostly education majors a little bit, other folks as well. And that's like, it's a 2-credit class. You can take it for 1 or 2 credit, meets once a week, and it goes for 16 weeks, and it kind of takes you through a program. And so what I find is, you know, there are a lot of reasons people take this class. And some of these reasons I find out ahead of time. So sometimes people will email me and just say, I'm very interested in this topic of mindfulness and what it might do for my performance, my ability to perform well. So I would say that primarily, at least at Jacobs, a lot of students are interested in how this practice is going to make them a better performer. And of course, when you say that, most people also in that statement, there's an implication that one of the reasons I'm not a good performer or I'm not performing at the level that I want to perform is that I have certain psychological or emotional blocks or processes or patterns of functioning that are keeping me from being a good musician or the musician that I want to be. So what I mean by that is, even though they're not telling me, they might be over anxious or maybe a little depressed or maybe a little bit lost in their orientation or maybe not understanding themselves, there's some of that is already baked into the I want to do mindfulness because, you know, I want to be a better performer. Right.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's the primary reason some people take it. Cause I think, A counseling office tells them, oh, you should take this class. It's really easy. It's only one credit. And I definitely get some of that. And I'll say this kindly. I usually tell them the first day of class, like, if you're taking this because you think you're just going to hang out and, you know, and listen to a few things and meditate and not turn anything in, it's probably not a good class for you. Yeah. You should probably quit now. And some of them hang on and eventually get something out of it. So I would say primarily that's the reason. They want to perform better. For teachers, I think some of them want maybe to connect to their students better and maybe feel a little less stressed out in general. So, you know, there's always that part of it as well. But yeah, definitely that's the main one. I want to be a better performer.
Yeah. So what are the challenges that usually crop up? So let's say I can imagine, like myself, I kind of came to mindfulness from a similar path. You know, saying, hey, this sounds great. I've had some dabbling in this here and there presented in a few different ways to me by different people. But this seems like something that could really help at least rein in the, you know, overactivity of my mind and my emotions on stage. But then once you get into mindfulness, you realize like how much of a practice it is, and it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of, you know, intention and commitment. So what are the challenges that usually crop up for those kinds of performers when they start to get into this class?
Good. That's a great question, because the typical trajectory is the first couple weeks, they're loving it. They're like, this is great. You know, I'm learning these really practical breathing exercises, body grounding exercises, awareness exercises, and I'm starting to see little changes in my performance. Maybe they're minuscule, but they're very, you know, they're significant enough that it catches their attention. But like anything else, after week three, what tends to happen, you know, it's usually week three or four here. It gets more stressful. You have more stuff to do. You've had more opportunities for negative interactions and experiences, right? So imagine somebody coming into school that first week, everybody's kind of in a good mood. Every interaction you have is kind of positive. You know, the sky's the limit. The world's my oyster. Then classes get a little hard, then the weather changes, then you've had a couple of maybe not great performance or practice sessions. And what happens in those situations to a lot of people who are doing mindfulness is that now is actually the time to really commit, right? Because you're actually dealing with the stuff, the things that mindfulness actually helps you with, which is the difficult stuff, right? In the beginning, there isn't a lot of difficult stuff to be dealt with compared to what's happening midway through, right? So what tends to happen then is now mindfulness is harder, right? Because you will typically default to your regular ways of dealing with problems, which is what got you in the class in the first place, right around that time, right? And then it becomes a struggle a little bit. And some of that struggle is making the time, you know, sort of convincing yourself, I could practice under a great deal of stress for an hour now because I have to get it done. Or I can commit 15 minutes to mindfulness, which would make this a 30 minute very effective practice, right? But it is so hard to convince yourself in those moments of duress that actually doing something that isn't the practice itself is going to help you do the practice better, right? And you're nodding your head as we see each other, because I think you understand this as you've gone through this process. So it's very hard during that time to convince people to just stay with it, do little chunks, keep going, because then there is another side of that, which once you come out of the other side and you've had an opportunity to actually work on these things, you'd realize that that commitment pays off, right? And that it really is going to take a much longer time to do this. And it's parallel to what happens in music, right? We start with, we can play it. It's fun. It's cool. We've got, and then it becomes challenging. And then during those challenging periods, we learn skills to get through the harder stuff. And then once we get through that harder stuff, then the harder stuff in the future is dealt with differently, right? But the hard part is getting through the harder stuff. So it's a similar challenge for folks who are doing these practices. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, saying that when it starts to get hard is when you really need to commit. Like, that's such an important thing to remember. And as you said, the hardest part of the whole process. Because I can remember times when, you know, when I was especially just first getting started in mindfulness, and like, I can remember that frame of mind, like, oh, this is great. I love it so much. And then all of a sudden, like a really hard concert cycle comes up or an audition comes up. And then all of a sudden, like all of my extra time, I'm just thinking about rep and working on practicing and everything else. And it's like, I don't have time to do a 10-minute, you know, body scan before I practice today. I'm just going to go right into it because I only have 50 minutes. I have to practice every possible second that I have. But quality, yeah. It's about quality, not quantity, as we know, but it's a hard thing to remember.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you have to make certain commitments and just prepare yourself mentally for the fact that yourself, your ego, your natural way of being is going to fight wanting to learn a new skill in a difficult circumstance, right? That's just human nature. So, you know, one way that I think, now that I've taught the class for many years, and I've been teaching this for a long time, I certainly made some changes to the class at Jacobs. One of the things that I want to start experimenting with next year is, first of all, making sure people understand this day one. And I tell them, but it doesn't matter, by week four, you forget. But changing it up a little bit, weeks three and four, or when it gets difficult. Like one thing I thought of is during those periods of time, setting up communal practice so that you have like an accountability buddy or accountability group that says, hey, we're going to get together. And even though it's tough, let's help each other. Because one of the things we're discovering is that practicing mindfulness in a group of peers versus practicing it by yourself has some challenges, but can also be really helpful if it's structured the right way, right? It's a group activity, just like anything else. It's like having a practice pod. You know, you're gonna help each other. And I think that could be, very, very helpful. So I think I want to start experimenting with possibly adding a little bit more of that communal type thing, relationship type building thing during the tough period so you can help people get through it. And there's other things as well that I think might help, but that's one of them that I've imagined.
Yeah, the communal aspect I think is extremely helpful. As you said, it's hard. It feels like another thing you have to try to schedule and meet up and everything else, but it's definitely worth it. As you said, just like the practice pod type approach, you know, playing excerpts for your friends and getting feedback and everything is so helpful. It's the same thing as committing to practicing, you know?
Yep.
So what are some other things that you've seen? So when it starts to get really hard, I know it's different for everybody, but are there certain types of practices that you found are easier to kind of, you know, get your feet back in there? Let's say you fall off the wagon for a week or two and then you're like, okay, I gotta get back into it. So what are some of the best ways to kind of get back in?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the things that I have focused on more the last few years are state change practices. State change, you know, just sort of telling people, look, you don't have to sit for 15 or 20 minutes or do a body scan along. You could do the short version of this, right? So, in my class, you know, there's always 4-7-8 that you can default to with a little mindful scan at the end where you teach people to do a breathing exercise that brings down their physiology. It doesn't take very long. There's an app you can get for it now, so you can just kind of schedule it. The other thing is the quick body scan where I just said, look, before you start, just do the start on the top of your head, go down, you know, change, you know, just kind of take stock of your emotions and your feelings and your intentions, and just the act of stopping for a minute before you play, right, is really, really helpful. The other thing I'm focusing a little bit more on now, and I certainly did a lot more of this this past year during the spring class, is, okay, so if you don't have time to do, let's say you somehow have convinced yourself you don't have time to do mindfulness formally or separately from your practice, turn your practice into a mindfulness session. So we have been developing some skills, some very interesting little ways of shifting what you do during your practice session to make it mindful. And that's been really interesting and very successful. Actually, I developed a whole new set of exercises. When I say I want to be really clear. I mean, we steal from each other. I hear people say something, oh, that might be a good idea. Mm-hmm. Let me see how I can make that work in this setting. And I did this really cool workshop with Gloria Lum, who is a cellist for the Los Angeles Philharmonic. She had something called Audition, I think it's called Audition Confidential, maybe. And she put together maybe 4-month long project where she had these cellists come in and meet with her once a week to try all of these different things to prepare for auditions. And she had, you know, professional folks from other symphonies there. Of course, she has incredible knowledge and extensive knowledge about this, but she had me come in as well and give 4 sessions. And what I did during those 4 sessions was to try to take what these folks already did in their practice and change it into a mindfulness task. And I got to tell you, that was some of the most successful, most quickly convincing practices that I think I've ever tried and seen in practice. So I'm trying to write those all down to remember what I did, because often I come up with them intuitively. But that's something I want to start incorporating into next year's class quite a bit.
That's really fascinating. I'd love to hear more about that. Can you think of an example or
sure.
on the spot to kind of put you on the
absolutely.
Spot?
One really cool practice that we tried was just shifting into different perceptions or perspectives, right? So one of the things that you learn in mindfulness is to not be fixed on a particular perspective, right? And a perspective can just be a mind state that is capitalized by overthinking or overfeeling or over ruminating. It could be anything really, but you're just kind of stuck there. So we, one little process that we took is I said, pick an excerpt that is, that you play pretty well, but that is difficult. It causes you a little bit of tension. I want you to just play it. Just play it up and down, maybe 45 seconds of it, and then write down where your thoughts are, where your emotions are, and, you know, like what your body feels like. Very quick. Okay, great. Now I want you to play it again. And this time I want you to shift your focus. And the first thing I want you to do is just shift your focus as you play this to the sound that you're hearing in the room, right? So not so much your own mind, not so much your own body, but just like focus on the external sound. Okay, great. Now I'll do the same thing again. Write it down. Now this time I want you to just focus on how the sound feels inside of you. Now I want you to focus on how it feels on your fingertips. Now I want you to focus on the resonance. So we basically moved through all these sensory modalities that kept you outside of your narrative self, right? Which is usually what gets in our way, is that speaking self that's just injecting predictive information and, you know, about how this is going to go and how to fix it, et cetera. And what we did is we actually then said, which one of those felt the best and which one of those sounded the best, right? And it was very interesting to watch. Just a shift in perspective freed up a lot of the stored up energy, or the energy that was being used for that narrative self, meaning that by default, there was more energy being committed to the music making. And it didn't even really matter which one, you know, which one you use. It's just the fact that you shifted yourself out of it. However, some people did find that, for example, when they shifted to a perception of resonance, a particular excerpt would go better. But for another excerpt, they found that just shifting or focusing their attention or resting their awareness on the sound in the room was better. Right. Huh. And we built all of these different exercises from that. Again, nothing, you know, nothing extraordinary there, but it is mindfulness, because you are forced in those situations to shift your attention, the focal point of your attention, to a different aspect of your mental processing, physical mental processing, while allowing for monitoring to go on. Right. And you're obviously curious, because you're creating a situation where you have no choice but to be curious. So it kind of hits all of the mindfulness sort of processes through a task that you would typically do anyway.
Yeah, the idea of changing the perception, I think, is so important to remember, because I think a lot of times when we're practicing, we're stuck in like analysis mode, like mental,
yes.
like we're processing what we're doing, we're trying to fix it, which is a necessary part of like musical development, as we all
sure.
know. However, we can't really be analyzing and trying to fix while we're performing on stage for a recital or for an audition, certainly, right? And
yes.
so practicing that skill of intentionally changing your perception, I think, is so important. I'd love to hear more. I'm sure everyone's like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. That's what I want to do, you know? So,
and it helps to coach through it too. For it's really hard to do it just off of a talk, right? You need somebody to coach you through it a little bit.
Right.
Because that coach has to be able to respond to you and help you shift with that, right? After you learn how to do it yourself, it's really easy to do. But yeah, I agree. And I know that in your work, and I remember when you were going through the MBWP program, that, you know, you had created warm-ups and certain activities that very much shifted the perception of where you were and what you were attending to, right? Which I'm mm-hmm. sure you found, you know, as a studio teacher and a performer, you know, that you don't you honestly can't spend 15 minutes on a mindfulness task if you have a 30-minute lesson, but
right.
you can incorporate some of that into the breathing in and into the actual performance and the warmups, and even the excerpt playing, right? Or the repertoire playing, that is really useful.
I've noticed too, just shifting, you know, like for example, working with some high school students over the summer in a summer camp, band camp thing, just asking them to notice what their shoulders felt like when we played through this really loud section, all of a sudden made everything sound easier. And it wasn't sharp anymore. And it was
yes.
louder. It was more resonant, all this stuff, just because I was getting them to think about a different, something else besides lips and tongue and teeth and embouchure and trying to fix it the whole time. Like everything else was able to just kind of go. But those little cues, like you said, from a coach just saying like, okay, let's try it this way. But now put your mental focus in this area, either on sensation or on perception of the room, resonance, as you said, or something like that, just to change things up. Such a huge
difference. Absolutely. And the mind responds in very interesting ways, you know, and as a person who does, you know, research in this area, scientific research and, you know, psychological research, you know, I love trying to find out what the mechanisms are, but ultimately what I'm more concerned with is, does it work? Right. I can give you 20 explanations for why that might happen. And I think that's a really interesting scientific question, psychological question. And it's fun to think about, right? Because we want to know that this is somehow founded on some kind of biological or neurological process that makes sense, right? On the other hand, you know, these practices have been around for thousands of years in some way, right? For different purposes. And very few people knew why they worked. You know, they just knew that they worked. And so the mechanisms are certainly one of my favorite things to consider. But I've certainly lost interest, but have become much more concerned with, let's try this and see if it works. You know, obviously based on some data, you know, it's not completely flying off, you know, just making something up on the spot. But sticking to some fundamental principles and seeing how you can combine them and recombine them. But yeah, novelty changes. You know, novelty changes the way the brain works, the mind works. I'd rather say that than the brain, because I'm including the body here and the environment and everything else. But once that changes, you know, what is it? What's the key here? And I think you may have pinpointed, right, one of those things, which is there's less going on in that analytical processing part, which, like you said, is important, but not always. Right. Not always. And that's how we've been taught to solve problems from the day we were, you know, started school, we were taught analysis and analyze a situation, solve a problem. Sometimes musical problems can't be solved by just using analytical methods, intellectual and conceptual analytical methods. And I'm not the first person to say that. Arnold Jacobs said that, you know, there are lots of people who have intuited that in many ways and will give you a different explanation, but yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of examples of times when I myself have experienced it, and I've seen it in others, friends, colleagues, whatever, where something that a little lick they couldn't play, or one measure that was just causing them fits, and they've spent hours and hours and hours trying to fix it and trying, you know, rhythm games and trying transposing it and faster, slower, whatever, all that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden they're just kind of sitting around and talking, and they just pick up their horn and they just play it perfectly. And they go like, what the heck was that? You know, because all of a sudden it's just a different, they're just in a different mental space for that little moment.
Absolutely. And the wider the repertoire of mental spaces that you can bring into your music making, not only is it going to be more enjoyable for you, but I think in many cases will make you a better performer. Not necessarily. I mean, there's some things that are just because you need the mental stimulation, right? And you need to change it. But but it's exactly what you said. And I've seen the same thing happen. I've seen the same thing happen to me. You know, when I was a pretty active brass player, I always had great high range chops, and I had a real mental block about playing in the lower range. And one excerpt that even to this day, I start getting tension just thinking about it is Cezanne Symphony number 3, Organ Symphony, you know, and for trombone, it starts on a low A flat, you know, and I'm not going to sing it because anybody's conception of me as a musician. But, you know, it never popped. I mean, I just would never, and everybody, you know, it's going to sound like a breath attack and it's going to be beautiful. And, oh man, I would freeze myself into the worst possible. And then, you know, it would come out as, bleh. But if I was just listening to Organ Symphony and I was in that mental state and pick up my trombone and just played the excerpt with the recording, it would all work. It would all, and I would try to pinpoint, why did it work that time? Why did it work that time? And it took me so long to figure out. It's just that I was in a different mental space, and I trusted that my body and my mind would know what to do. And that trust, this is one of the things that mindfulness at the deeper level develops, because in the beginning, you're not working on that. You're working on deconstructing a lot of the things that are causing you blocks. But as you get deeper and deeper into the practice, you start to develop a trust in a sort of innate basic intelligence and wisdom that the human body and mind has to create art and to use your body in a way that maybe doesn't make sense intellectually, right? And it can't be written down or put into a Phil Farkas embouchure picture from that crazy book.
Yeah.
You know, but that works, and your body and mind came up with it. And the more you inject your intellect into it, the less likely it is that it's going to function for you, right? So we have to be comfortable. This is kind of, you have to be comfortable with not knowing why something works. Right? Just like in life, sometimes you don't know why it works, but you're glad it does.
Yeah.
And hey, I more power to you if you can find those moments where you lean into that bit of intuitive knowledge about performance that doesn't come from anything but experimentation and your mind figuring it out on a different level.
Yeah, the idea of trust, I'm so glad you said that, because it's such an important aspect. And the idea of, and I think a lot of where that comes from too is when you've talked about mindfulness, when I was learning it from you, you talked a lot about getting, like, we spend a lot of time from the shoulders up. And I talk about that a lot too, you know, and reminding ourselves that we have a body. And part of that trust, I think, is that, like, we're so concerned about, like, the mental processes of, like, constructing this perfect sound or this perfect excerpt or whatever, that we're trying to think our way through the creation of this, you know, quote, perfect, unquote, art. And dropping into your body takes a lot of trust, and it takes a lot of trust to not have to manipulate every little thing and be like super focused on your embouchure or on your left hand position or on your bow arm or whatever you're trying to do technically. The trust that all is going to be there and just like let your body do it, right? When people talk about that whole flow concept, right, that's really where that's getting to, is like getting out of your own head. It's all the you know, descriptions of what flow feels like is like, I don't know, I was out of my head that night, or I was, you know, I just like happened. I wasn't even there. I was like watching myself from the first row, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And so you're providing what I think is really critical anecdotal evidence that we process very intelligently all the time without needing to know exactly what's going on. And I'm going to bring up an example that I want to make sure people don't take too far, right? But driving. Mm-hmm. I have found anecdotally, again, this is an anecdote, that the people who are the worst drivers are the people who are hyper-focused when they drive. They tend to hyper-focus on a particular part of the road without seeing the periphery. They tend to overthink their steering. You can see it. I get in cars with people like this. I'm like, just allow the environment to inform you and then watch as your body responds, right? The car becomes an extension of you. And it's very, well, as the minute you get in a car, like I remember first starting learning how to drive, it felt like it's a foreign thing stuck to my body. But now when I get in a car and think about it, I turn, you know, and there's a kind of way that my body catches the environment and responds intelligently and ahead of time without me knowing, right? Which allows me to listen to the radio and do other things. Now, again, there are times, for example, if I'm driving a very dangerous part of town where my focus is going to change, you know, and when there's more, I'm like, okay, now I've got to focus, right? But imagine maintaining that over an 8-hour road trip. It's not possible. I think music is very much the same, right? You are driving your vehicle, your instrument, but at some point you become symbiotic with that instrument and it becomes less like everything else in your world. You move your hands without thinking. You want to pick up a cup, you pick up the cup, right? And it takes a while to train that because it's got to become part of your body. But part of what mindfulness does is it allows you to create mental spaces, physical, mental, body spaces, mind, body spaces, in which that sort of symbiosis can develop kind of naturally and inform your playing. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, it's so many important things. And it's so great to have another explanation of all that stuff and to remind me that I'm processing that just the same as everyone else and trying to keep myself in that kind of a state that I want to be in. But most importantly, I think, is gaining, like you said, the ability to choose what kind of mental state or emotional state that you're in. It becomes easier to be able to choose, you know, when we're working on these skills of mindfulness.
Yeah, you got a repertoire.
Right. Another area I'd love to talk about, kind of dovetailing off of this, is so when we work on these mind-body states and changing our mental perceptions of practicing and everything else, part of what we start to realize is the kind of internal dialogue and discussion that we're having and that kind of running commentary that's happening. So how, because musicians, we're really good at being really mean to ourselves without even knowing. And I've tried to bring this up with as many people as I can, just like, be aware of the kinds of things you're telling yourself, because you probably wouldn't be friends with yourself if you said that to, you know, if you were a friend saying that to somebody else. Let's talk about that for a bit. Maybe just kind of how to deal with those things, maybe dealing with the realization that you're being unnecessarily, you know, cruel to yourself, and you're maybe without even realizing it.
Sure. So that is actually probably the most common, when we were talking about common, that's something that comes up almost immediately in these classes or in any kind of workshop that I teach on mindfulness. It's a sort of inner critic or inner narrative. And so the very first thing I think that people need to realize is this is perfectly normal, right? There's pretty good research, emerging research on the mind or the brain as a sort of predictive engine, in which, you know, part of what your mind is trying to do, it is trying to figure out what is going to happen such that it can be in a physiological and mental and emotional state to respond in a way that helps you survive. Right? That's pretty much it. It keeps you integrated psychologically, mentally, otherwise, right? And so your mind is a prediction machine. And so it's constantly predicting the future, right? And that's a very useful thing, because without predicting the future in some way, we couldn't function. Now, okay, so what goes into that predictive process? Well, part of it is sort of that narrative, right? That narrative that is constantly reminding you of the kind of human being you are, producing memories to support that, you know, producing future situations that you're projecting yourself into to continue to support this sense of survival, right? And because for many people, that narrative that is involved in that predictive processing is negative, they try to suppress it, or they completely succumb to it, not realizing that it's like any other habit. It's just something, this is a way that you have learned to survive, and then your body is not going to, and your mind is not going to change as long as you are surviving for the most part. Right. So, so it might be hard, but you know, yeah, I might call myself a jerk or a loser 30 times, but I've gotten this far. Why would I change that? Why would I, what your brain say? No, it's too much energy. So I think the very first thing to sort of make it simpler is to say, let's just acknowledge that I have an inner narrative. Let's acknowledge that my inner narrative developed not because it's true, but because it has been a good way for me to solve basic problems to some degree. Now, if you're chasing mindfulness, you've probably figured out that some of the way your inner narrative chooses those problems to fix those problems no longer works. You're trying to find a way to help it, right? And suppressing it is not going to work. You cannot suppress your narrative making self. It's not possible. So what can you do? Well, first of all, you can just notice it, right? Which is exactly what you just kind of notice it for what it is. It's a narrative. It's a storytelling. You are a storyteller. Your mind is going to tell stories. It's going to tell good stories or bad stories. It's always going to tell a partial story, because it's never going to know the full truth of any situation. So once you realize that logically, you're like, okay, well, that might be true, but other things could be true as well. And just in the act of recognition that this is a story you're telling yourself and that it's fine, that creates a little space for saying, okay, now that I know that, could I inject a different story in there? Right. Or as you remember, maybe from MBWP training, is this a useful thought? Is this the true? Is it real? You know, ultimately all thoughts are real. Not all thoughts are true. And every thought that is true is partially true. It's only true from your perspective, because there's always a very different ways of looking at a particular thing. Right. And we're not talking about mathematical truths or things like that. We're talking about experiences and perceptions. Right. So I start with telling people first of all, notice when it comes up. When it comes up, don't resist it. Just watch it. Kind of watch it the way you watch a movie. Then ask yourself that question. Is this useful? Is this useful right now? And the thing is, in order to know whether something is useful or not, you have to have an intention to compare it to. So if your intention is, I want to be a kind person, or I want to perform this particular thing, whatever, if that's what you're holding in mind, all of a sudden that thought is incompatible with that, you know, then pick one that's compatible with it, right? And you practice this like anything else. You're going to stumble, you're going to, you know, and over time, you stop believing your thoughts as much. And you start realizing that a lot of that process can be reset and can be more flexible. the other side of this, Kevin, I won't talk too long about it, is one way to it, you know, if you want to talk about a way to suppress that kind of thinking, I wouldn't say you can suppress it, but I think you can also just shift your awareness to just your bodily experience. And that diminishes the role of that narrative, right? So, you know, you have a limited amount of attentional resources. That's how human beings are. We'd go crazy otherwise. So if you know that they're limited, then use that to your advantage. Say, well, right now I'm going to go right into the feelings in my body and my emotions. Because see, experience, physical embodied experience doesn't need, I mean, the same physical embodied experience can have 20 different narratives attached to it, right? If it's late at night and I feel sleepy, I have the sensation of feeling physically sleepy, then that's great. My narrative is, oh, this is so nice. I'm so glad I'm physically sleepy. The next day I'm trying to stay awake during a class and I feel the same way. And what does my narrative say? Oh, this is bad. Oh my gosh, I can't, right? So it's the same exact feeling with a different interpretation. Now imagine having the flexibility to choose the narrative that is attached to those particular experiences, right? And part of what's fun about or useful about dropping into your body is that those experiences will eventually have a particular character and quality to it. And they're not always under your control, but you can almost always choose what to do with those experiences. And part of what you choose, how you choose what to do, is to develop narratives that are more useful for your intentions. Ooh, that was a long explanation.
That's awesome. There's so many great things in there I wanted to just touch on. But one thing I'm picking up is a reminder of that, like curiosity as kind of an undertone. Yes. So thinking about like, oh, I wonder, that's interesting. I wonder why that thought popped into my head. Or, and then from there too, going at, because one of the challenges I think for a lot of musicians is dealing with analyzing our own performance, either in the moment of a practice session or whatever, trying to fix things, work on the techniques of things or whatever, or like listening back to recordings, as I always say that because it's so important for us all to record a bunch of stuff and listen back, right? But yeah, a lot of people have a lot of blocks with that, emotional blocks, you know, mental blocks with listening to our own recordings, because it becomes this another area where we can just be like unnecessarily cruel to ourselves, right? Yeah. Like, God, yes, I'm so bad at this. I can't believe I missed that one note. I'm such a horrible musician. Like, I don't deserve a job, blah, blah, blah. And there's just this like snowball of horrible,
right?
But yes, changing that curiosity, like, I wonder why that note was like that. Or I wonder what caused, you know, this, that, or the other thing. The same thing with our mental state and our narrative. Like, I wonder, you know, what's causing those thoughts? Like, maybe my blood sugar is really low and I'm really tired today because I didn't eat enough breakfast, or just being curious about maybe some of the other contributing factors that could be causing an extra amount of those kind of unnecessary or unhelpful thoughts.
Absolutely. Yes. Curiosity as a disposition is a fierce antidote to suffering. Mental and physical otherwise, right? And it is something you can cultivate. You have to cultivate it though, right? Like that is a choice that when you notice you going in a particular direction, now you have to switch to, oh, and let me just be curious. Because in curiosity, information gathering is an information gathering in a sort of neutral way, in a way which might produce awe or insight. That's what that type of functioning does, right? And it is the opposite of solving a problem. You know, when I'm being curious about a problem, I don't necessarily have to solve it. I'm just curious. Why? And in that curiosity, you have three or four possibilities, maybe more. And now you're like, well, there's four or five reasons there. I can choose. I don't know which one might be true. But what if this one's true? What would that say? Right. And yeah, it really shuts down a lot of this overtly controlling, egotistic, self-centered processing that keeps us from confronting, you know, yeah, sometimes we don't always perform at the level we want. Right. And by the way, I say that, but that's pretty normal. Like that's just how it's to developmentally, it's normal to develop an ego and a concept of self. Right. But if you hold on to tightly to that as a musician or anything else, then, you know, it's, and you make it impenetrable, or you depend on your, you know, selfhood being completely tied to it, it's just not going to work. You can try, but it's not going to work. It's going to cause you tremendous suffering because honestly, you're not in control of all of that. Well, you know, one day you might have a freaking cold sore. And yeah, you know what? The reason you didn't play that well is you had a cold sore. or one day you had a really terrible thing happen that moment and in that morning, and you're not feeling emotionally up to it, or you, and so, you know, if you're not aware that sometimes these things are out of your control, you can be incredibly judgmental because you put the entire onus on you. And I get it. We have this sort of narrative of self-responsibility. Only you can do it. Yeah, okay, sure. To some degree, we have agency over what we can do. Absolutely. But we also have to understand that we are agents within a much, much larger, larger field of interactions that are not under our control. And so when you dance with your experience through curiosity, right, rather than try to control it, when you dance with it, when you surf it, you're more likely to find not only an enjoyable path, but probably a path that is going to help you achieve the goals that you want to achieve.
Yeah. The idea of having your own self-worth and your concept of selfhood and of value as a human being be extended beyond just your contribution as a musician to the world is invaluable advice. I can think of a very specific, good anecdote to kind of explain that. But we were at IU, Rose and I both, when we were there, and we went and saw the Pacifica Quartet play. And we went backstage afterwards, and she just congratulated some of the members, and she's like, "Oh my God, that was so fantastic!" And this, you know, this piece here, this movement that's like notoriously very difficult for the ensemble, she's like, "It was just amazing." And then like, "Yeah, but I missed this and this, and I didn't play this well, and I missed the shift and all this stuff." And Rose and I were both just kind of like dumbstruck, like, okay, so it's everybody.
it is every single musician I have met to some degree does that. And the point is, at some point you realize like, that's actually okay on some level. It's just how personally you take it and whether you let that define you forever, right? And so, you know, there's really great research from Center for Healthy Minds, Richie Davidson's lab up in Wisconsin. You know, the guys really started doing a lot of that meditation neuroscience research. And some of Richard's early research on well-being and resilience, right, is how quickly that, like, one indicator of well-being is not that people don't experience difficulty, it's just how quickly they recover from it, how quickly they shift through that and not become attached, right? So you know, non-attachment to, you know, like, just let the curse word out and call yourself all the names, let it, and then just move on, right? Like, just holding on to it is what makes it worse, right? And so in his study of resilient, psychologically resilient people, they weren't any less disturbed by things in their life, or they didn't push things down, they just kind of washed through them, right? You know, there's this really beautiful sort of image in the Zen Buddhist tradition of priests being insui. I'm going to say that wrong. I got to remember the term for it. Essentially means cloud, right? You become cloud nature. Well, you know, a cloud is just constantly shifting, right? It's a thing that is created by all of the conditions around it. And of course it has a boundary, kind of like yourself, but it's just, you know, it's shifting. It's always a cloud, but it's shifting. It doesn't stay stuck. And that's why it continues to do what it does, right? Well, we're little clouds, right? You take us out of spatial temporal time, and you know, you extend that, and we're just little clouds that come into existence for a little bit and fluctuate and come out, right? So if you're knowing that that's the nature of your experience, you're not going to cling on to things so much. You're going to sort of ride it a little bit more. And so, yeah, the cloud sometimes gets dark and there's rain, and sometimes it snows, and sometimes it's there, sometimes it's thin, sometimes it's, you know, great, you know. Musical life is very much like that too.
Yeah.
Right. With of course the added agency that, as far as we know, clouds don't have any agency, right? But we have some, yeah. We actually have some influence over how the cloud forms. Right.
Yeah. I know that there's a lot of people out there that maybe are dancing with the idea of starting some mindfulness practices, or maybe your words have inspired them to like, okay, this is going to be the semester where I actually go for it, you know? Yeah. So what would you recommend if they don't have access to, you know, a course that they can take or a teacher that they know of close by? What are some of the best ways to kind of get started in trying to integrate some mindfulness practices into their life?
Sure. Well, I mean, just to be clear, even if you get a coach for two sessions, doesn't matter who, just a good coach to help you figure stuff out, that's worth it. It's worth the investment. It really is. But let's say you don't, right? What's the best thing you can do? I think the best thing you can do is actually practice. Don't read so much about it. I mean, reading is great, but reading is taking advantage of those intellectual processes we're very much trying to not I'm not gonna say devalue, but to put in better weight with the rest of your experiences in the ways that you process, right? So get an app. Get a simple app, a cheap app. It doesn't matter, you know, my favorite ones still are Headspace. I think that's still a nice app to get. There's a bunch of others of Calm. Get yourself a free app and just commit to 5 minutes a day before you practice. 10 minutes or little meditations in there. If you're not going to have a teacher, if you're not going to have a coach, if you're not, you know, then that in itself is transformative enough. I recommend a few. I mean, if you're into like reading about, if you're like, yeah, but I need the inspiration of hearing people talk about this. Well, of course there's your podcast now. Another one I love is Dan Harris's 10% Happier podcast. Man, you're going to get some great stuff there. Put that on your playlist. Dan Harris, Sam Harris, sorry. Not a fan of some of the things he does and says sometimes, but in terms of speaking about meditation, a lot of what he says, I think, is really valuable, but even more valuable is the kind of people he has on that podcast are really wonderful. And they talk about meditation and mindfulness and contemplative practices in a way that I think are really compelling. And so just listening to it, you know, going to the gym, listening to it, you might say, okay, this is really cool. Let me go back and try it for 5 minutes. Right. So they kind of help each other out. Right. But ultimately, once you've done that, you know, I think committing to a class or having a coach, even for just a few sessions, is really, really helpful. Well, okay, here's the answer. It's like saying, how do I become a wonderful horn player that wins auditions without having a teacher and without having resources? Well, you can go to YouTube.
Yeah.
Certainly learn something. You can live, but ultimately, if you want to really, really benefit from something like this, you got to commit yourself to it. And part of that, yeah, part of it is a financial investment on some level. Although, gosh, there's so many people out there who teach this stuff and do it for, who are very good, who don't do it for a lot of money. You know, you don't have to spend a bunch of money, but it's the same thing. You want to sound better on your horn? Well, part of it is you got to get a good horn.
Yeah.
You got to do that, right? So at some point, if this becomes a very serious thing for you, you got to commit the kind of time and energy and resources financially, emotionally, and otherwise to make it work.
Yeah, the idea of there's so many great online resources and stuff now these days, like all the big insight centers and meditation centers around the country, most of them have some like really inexpensive classes you can enroll in for like one-off sessions and things like that. So there's lots of ways to find some access to teachers that are both reasonably priced and easily to access, being that there a lot of them are online. You can't really compete with a really good teacher in person and feeling that connection and hearing their voice in the actual room, but there's ways to at least help you out a little bit. So,
and I should start the plug now. MBWP is coming back.
Woohoo!
I don't know how or what, it's gonna have to change, but I do plan in the next year. Like I've really been thinking of bringing it back, resurrecting it in some way, being much more of a sort of a la carte type thing where you want a couple sessions with a teacher. We've got some people who are great, you know, and they could do it for you online. You know, you want a longer training thing. Maybe we can do that, you know, but, the plan is to bring it back now that the pandemic, well, it's not over, but that we seem to have reached some peace with whatever this is.
Yeah.
And that, you know, barring some incredibly unstable event in the next few years, you know, maybe can regain some momentum. I know that'd be a nice thing, 'cause that was a really good group of teachers, you being one of them. And one of the nice things about that is, as you mentioned, is that you were trained, right? You didn't just read a book and show up on this, I'm going to teach this. You and a lot of other folks committed to really learning how to do this in very creative ways and are doing it right now. And it'd be nice to have a place, one of many, where people can find teachers who they know are going to be actually helpful.
Yeah. I'd love to be involved again.
It's all there. It's all hidden under a website.
Yeah. Right.
I just need new bio pictures.
Yeah. So we all look like we can show the COVID weight that we've gained maybe, or the, you know, the advanced age of some grays in the temples and, you know,
that makes you a better teacher, right?
It does. Yeah.
The wisdom lines.
Yeah. Well, Frank, thank you so much. This was so fantastic, because I knew it would be. It's always great to hear you discuss these topics and to explain them in such eloquent and inspiring ways. And I hope that we can plan many more kind of peppered throughout this podcast life cycle, and I'm sure everyone's looking forward to the next one as much as I am.
Sounds great. And thanks for being here. And thanks for just, it was fun having this discussion, and good luck to everybody who's doing this thing. And I can't wait to hear the podcast. Once it's out, let me know and I'll share it widely.
Will do. Thanks again, Frank.
Okay. All right. Take care, Kevin.
Bye. Another huge thank you to Frank for a wonderful conversation. And thank all of you so much for listening. You can keep up to date on all new podcast releases and other exciting news by following me on Instagram at Mindful Musical Life, or by visiting the website, mindfulmusicallife.com. If you have a suggestion for a future topic or guest, please reach out. I'd love to hear your ideas. Remember, anyone who might be interested in mindfulness coaching can reach out via Instagram or my website to schedule a free 30-minute consultation. And lastly, if you like the podcast, please take a minute to rate, review, and subscribe. Thank you again for listening, and see you next time.